Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, where we get together each week and explore what's new and what's going on in the world of technology from a blind and partially sighted perspective. If you want to get in contact with us, please do. As we always say, it's your program, and we mean that. So get in touch if you've got any comments or anything you want to share. techtalk@rnib.org.uk is our email address. You can send a written email, or you can attach a voice note as well. Coming up this week, Steve Nutt runs down some of the big announcements from the recent Made by Google event. We'll be hearing about the STEM charity that's been established to support blind and partially sighted young people. Plus, how do you keep yourself safe when using AI chatbots? Hubert Pavalkovich has been finding out as we continue our AI series. Joining me this week, Jackie Brown and Natalie Curran. Hubert is sunning himself in America somewhere. So welcome in to both of you. Natalie, I'll come to you first. What's new with you this week?
Hi, Callum. I had an unusual week this week. I did a lot of arguing with ChatGPT, but I won't go into that. What sort of tickled me a bit was Spotify, because I was listening to Spotify on my laptop. As I said a few weeks ago, that I found the app reasonably accessible. And I went onto my phone because whilst I found the desktop app reasonably accessible, I wanted to edit my playlist or check something in my playlist. And I thought the mobile app tends to be easier, so I'll just do it quickly on my phone. And I did. And I was surprised when I went onto the app to see that it said pause as opposed to play. But I thought, I wonder, does it know that I'm playing on a different device? So I selected it, and it paused the music on my laptop. And then I hit play again, and it started playing from my phone from exactly the same position. So I realised that basically the two of them were effectively talking to each other. I thought, this is quite useful. So I selected a different song on my phone, got it playing on my phone, hit pause, then went back to my laptop and hit play and got it to continue from there. And it's such a small thing, but I thought, actually, that's quite useful.
That's pretty slick, isn't it?
Yeah, if you do find one easier to use than the other.
I wish Apple Music had something like this. I think it's meant to kind of, it's not really the same. It's meant to via the AirPods. It's meant to, like, you can put the AirPods in and they'll go to one device. And then if you start playing music or a podcast on another device, it should kind of, another Apple device, that is, it should automatically kind of switch over.
Other thing I was going to add is, if anybody is using the Spotify desktop app, regions is quite a good way for navigating. Headings aren't so good, but R for regions, or JAWS key plus control plus R, I find it's a useful way of getting around. Just thought I'd mention that as well.
All right, sounds good. Jackie, anything caught your eye this week?
Well, I've been playing with an app which is only available on iOS, unfortunately. It's another OCR app, but this one apparently is very basic and also doesn't send any information to the cloud. So it is completely offline, which some people would feel more comfortable using. And it's called Tap Reader, and that's TAPREADER. So it's available from the App Store. There is a charge. It's £1.99. But it is actually not a bad little app if you just want something basic. When you load the app, you just have a couple of buttons to deal with. You get a welcome message. And once you've got past that, you don't have to create an account or anything. You've just got two buttons on the screen, really. One is English pop-up button, so you would double tap that if you want to change the language, and the other one is your scan button, and if you double tap that, the scan button then becomes your read button, so you can actually faff around on the screen looking for the text that it just scanned, or you can double tap on the read button and a voice, which is Alex, voiceover Alex. He's very slow on it, and it sounds as if he's been to the pub for a few. There's no way of of yeah, well, there's no way of speeding him up, so you're stuck with that. But to be honest, if you're happy with your regular voiceover voice, then you don't even need to type in to the read bit, and it will just read what's on, what it's scanned for you. But it's basic, but it is, quite a good little app for those people that just want something very, very simple. They want it offline, and if you just search for it in the app store, if you just search for it in the app store, it is Tap Reader, and that's a capital T, capital R, all one word.
Ah, very nice. Tap Reader. I think I'm guessing because this is local, does it I'm guessing you can't do like questions about it and things like that, or can you?
I got the impression from what I've played with so far that if you move your finger, flick up on the screen where the text is that you've just scanned, it does give you the option to share, or rather explore. So I'm guessing that it isn't overly complex. It's really designed just for, taking a shot. And what I did like about it was very quick. As soon as you double tapped on the scan button, you would get the flash of your camera, and it reads it almost instantly. And I'm also told, I haven't had any handwritten stuff to try out yet, but I'm also told it does read handwriting. So that's another positive.
I like the sound of that, Jackie, because of the not sending it to the cloud aspect
Yeah.
for medical letters.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about anybody else, but I don't get them in Braille or in an accessible format. And I don't like using something like Seeing AI for something like that, because that is very personal information. And I don't know where it's going. Yeah, so I might give that a go.
That's why I mentioned it, because I thought, well, yes, it is a very basic app, and there are a lot of OCR apps out there now, let's be honest. But at the same time, if you just want something dead simple, dead quick, and know that it isn't going to go to the cloud, then I think Tap Reader is a good one to try.
See, it's funny you talk about the local aspects. That is important. So I've obviously, I think I've said it on the show before, I've recently moved house in the last few weeks, and I needed to submit proof of address for something that I was applying for. And because we're new to this house, I haven't really got much yet in terms of proof of address. I've not had many bills come through and stuff. But I did have something from my energy supplier, which I thought might have my address on it. It wasn't a bill as such, it was like a statement. And I thought, I don't know if this has got my address. So I got the PDF, sent it off to Aira with their Access AI, because I know that's a bit more professional and has a bit more of a privacy focus with the nature of it being Aira. But after I'd done it, and it did give me the information, I verified it with the agent and everything. But after I'd done it, I thought, yeah, I'll still just send that to AI, and that's got incredibly personal information on there. Not great. Really quick one from me this week is similar to the AI features, actually. A quick update on the Meta glasses. They've had a new software update released. They've now added audible support. So you can ask your glasses directly to, well, you can ask the Meta Assistant to play your audible books if you connect it up, similar to how you can with music services. And they've also added calendar support as well for, I think it's just Outlook and Google calendars at this stage that are supported. I don't have either of those. I'm using iCloud, so I've not been able to try this out. But apparently, according to the release notes, you can ask what's on your calendar, the Meta Glasses, what's on your calendar for certain days, and add events as well. So that might make managing your calendars.
I don't have that update. I don't have it yet. I've been trying to get it all week because somebody on one of the forums pointed out that it's available, and apparently you go into accessibility. But I've been in there, and I don't see it at all. I've looked right the way through the app. The glasses say they're up to date, so maybe they're just doing that the same way that they rolled out the AI features.
It's the typical Meta way, isn't it? The phased rollout. So I've got the update, and I do have the option of Audible, but I can't see anything related to calendars anywhere. So, yeah, I've half got it. But yeah, keep an eye on your, if you're interested in those, just keep an eye on your Meta app, really. Don't start messing about with VPNs. It's just,
No.
it will come eventually. It's fine. All right. Cheers, guys. Stick with us. Another interesting week, as always. This is Tech Talk.
Well, with me this morning is my RAG, and RAG stands for Resident Android Guru. So, welcome, Steve Knott.
I like that one. I'm a rag. Great
Yeah.
stuff. Okay.
Well,
Hello,
you
Jackie.
are our resident Android guru. You would always know probably most before most of the people I know about what's happening with Android. And of course, there has been a Google event recently. So first, can you tell us about what you know regarding the Google event? What's been released? What is being released?
Well, I can't say much about accessibility simply because the Google event didn't mention much about accessibility.
Tut
But
tut.
one, but one, th yeah, tut tut, absolutely tut tut. But however, one thing that came out of it for me, and I don't know if you know this, Jackie, but there's a new feature in the Pixel 10 line, and I think it's Pixel 10 only, called Camera Coach. Now,
Oh.
Camera Coach is not a thing for the blind people, and it's not accessible. It's not a thing that's accessible necessarily. But what got my impression, my attention with Camera Coach is that it tells sighted people what settings to use on the camera, where to position the camera when, to take the best pictures and all that lot. And if that becomes accessible with TalkBack, I firmly believe blind people could take pictures.
Yes, so a bit of a game changer, I would
That'd
say.
be fascinating, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That excites me. I must admit, the whole thing with sight as a service excites me. Like, I've got the Meta glasses, obviously, which is not part of the conversation today, but we was walking around, went for a walk this morning, and I was just asking them what they see and things like that, and it's fascinating. And so this camera coach could be a real game changer for blind people if they want to take pictures, I don't know. I haven't tried it, even as a beta tester for TalkBack. I haven't tried it yet because I haven't got a Pixel 10. It's coming on Thursday, my Pixel 10 Pro. So I'm very much looking forward to trying Camera Coach. Now, that was the main thing that came out of the event. And the other thing that came out was very interesting, and that is apparently when you get a new Pixel 10, if or a new, I think they're going to do it for all Android phones eventually, but at the moment it's for the Pixel 10. When you set it up, I believe it asks you what phone you've got. And if you've got an iPhone, it will ask you to plug in your iPhone to the USB-C cable and connect it to your Pixel. And apparently it will suck all the information from the iPhone, and it says including passwords and things like that. So presumably they've got access to iOS password manager and things like that, which is fascinating to me. Fascinating because, Apple have always been all on about security, haven't they? And how secure their phones are. So
Yeah.
how are Google getting at Apple's password? That fascinates me. But if it works, that's an ideal way for people to switch from iOS to Android. You just plug in your iPhone to an Android phone and it sucks all the information in. That could be good, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's really useful because there are a lot of visually impaired people now who do have an iPhone and they also have an Android device because they like a foot in both camps. And I'm one of those people. You're one
Me
of those
too.
people. So it is really useful if you want to have your Google Pixel to have the same information on it as your iPhone. To be able to do that. So that's quite cool. But what else was at the event? There were earbuds, I believe, and a new watch. Do you know anything about those?
Yeah, so the earbuds are, I'm glad you mentioned the watch because there's something exciting about the watch as well, but the earbuds, the Pixel 2a, these are the Pixel Buds 2a, and these are they're not as good, well, they're not as high quality as the Pixel Buds 2 Pro, which I've already got, but they are a cheaper version, so people can get into Pixel Buds. And Pixel Buds are really quite good in terms of sound quality. You know, any Pixel Buds are pretty good. Even the original Pixel Buds were good. And do you know, Pixel Buds, now, I don't know if you know it, this, Jackie, but Pixel Buds are the most accessible headphones or earbuds you can buy, because A, they do wireless charging, which I know some of the AirPods Pro do as well, and the AirPods 2 or something, but they have wireless charging, right? But when you put it on the wireless charger, the headphones beep. Okay. Now, I've never heard headphones do that before, you know, other than the Pixel Buds. Sony headphones certainly don't, so you don't know that they're actually charging, you know. But these you do. When you put it on charge, they beep. And then when you take it off charge, they beep. And there's also a button on the earbuds that you can ring your phone, so you can find your phone if you've left it somewhere else in the house.
Yeah.
And the same with the phone, isn't it? You know, from the Pixel Buds app, you can ring your earbuds and they will beep, so you can find them. I think that's quite good. Really.
Yeah, it is. I don't personally use earbuds, so you know, that is a useful a useful feature to have. You mentioned the watch. What's happening with that?
The Pixel Watch 4 apparently is going to be the first watch that has loss of pulse detection. So what that means is if you're wearing the watch and it doesn't detect a heartbeat, it will call emergency services. I think that's good.
Yeah, yep, that is.
And that, you know, that's a real useful feature. You know, if you have a heart attack or something like that, and you lose heartbeat, and you know your watch is going to call emergency services, that's a really good thing. Apparently, there are other health things, because they're now linked with Fitbit and things like that. So they've got Fitbit exercise, they've got Fitbit ECG, but all the other watches have got that Fitbit Relax. Fitbit Breathe, where you do breathing exercises with it and all that. So they're quite good watches. But I did like the idea of this loss of pulse detection in the Pixel Watch 4. You know, I mean, I can see a scenario where you could put that on an elderly relative, couldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, and then you could track it with your phone rather than theirs. Do you know what I mean? And that would be quite good, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the actual features of the Pixel 10? I mean, you've ordered one. I'm not going for one this year, because my Pixel 9 is fine, and I don't need to update. It's my other phone, as I call it, so I don't want to update this year. But what is if you like pertinent about the Pixel 10 this year, apart from what we've talked about already?
Battery life. Apparently, it is better. Apparently, 9to5 Google did a test with the Pixel 9 Pro and the iPhone 16 Pro, and they said the Pixel 9 Pro gave 45 minutes more battery life than the iPhone.
Okay.
So apparently they've closed the gap, because iPhone has always been better with battery, you know. And now apparently Google have closed the gap, and in fact they're beating them now on the Pro line. That was tested on a brand new phone, you know, discharging and charging the battery several times, you know. And the reason I'm buying Pixel 10 is purely for the camera coach, to be honest. I think if you've got a Pixel 9 or a Pixel 9 Pro, even a Pixel 8, you don't need to rush out and get a Pixel 10. There's nothing in that would compel the average user to go and buy it. And I'm not talking down to other users when I say the average user. But, you know, if you're not a nerd like me, you don't need to buy it. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And what about the fingerprint sensor? How's that coming along? Because, you know, some versions of the Pixel 10, if you go back a couple of versions, you know, it's not quite as good, the fingerprint sensor, as say the 8 and the 9. So just wondering if you've heard anything about whether that's been improved.
Well, yes, it has. I mean, they do say the fingerprint and the face unlock has been improved as well. I don't think the Pixel 10 still doesn't unlock what with your face in the pitch dark, which the iPhone can do. I don't think the Pixel 10 does that. So, you know, it's best keep it realistic. But fingerprint, I mean, I don't have problems with fingerprint on the Pixel 9, to be honest, on the 9 Pro. I don't have any issue with fingerprint on that. Although most of the time I use my face if there's enough light. If it says not enough light, then I use fingerprint. And it does tell you, doesn't it?
It does.
You heard it say that?
Yes.
It says not enough light.
Not enough light. Yeah.
Yeah. So if it says that, then just use your fingerprint. That's why. That's the way I do it. I do face first, you know. And if it doesn't recognize me, then I use a fingerprint. Now I find the fingerprints, you know, okay, really. And I guess it will improve more in the Pixel 10. They didn't really mention that, I don't think, in the event, but I think it will improve on that.
And overall, with Android, we're on version 16 now. They're saying that you would get up to 7 years security with the new phones.
Yep.
So is there anything outstanding that you'd like to tell us about in regard to Android 16, or is there anything sort of eye-catching, if you'll pardon the pun?
Not really. I think again, Android 16 is generally better with battery life. What you will find with Android, now I ought to explain, because I don't think we've explained this at all on Tech Talk, and I think we ought to explain that with Apple, you've just got Apple, right? So every phone that you get, every iOS phone, every iPhone that you get, will always get the latest update, right? That's not true with Android, because Google don't have control of Android, because Android is allowed to be, you know, used by other manufacturers.
Yeah.
So the reason I'm mentioning this is if you buy a Sony phone or a Samsung phone, or, you know, any other phone, Huawei, any phone you like, you may not get 16 for 6 months to a year after Google have released it.
Yes.
But on a Pixel, if you buy a Pixel, and I always recommend blind people buy Pixel, because you get the latest talkback and you get the latest Android all the time. So you are best buying a Pixel, because then you've got the same experience as Apple have with iPhone, if that makes sense. You've always got the newest experience, but you don't. If you buy a non-Pixel, if you buy a Samsung or any other phone, you won't get the updates as quickly as you do with Google. With Google, you'll get it on the day of release. And that sometimes that's useful because, for example, I'm sure we've had this conversation before, Samsung do their own spin on TalkBack, don't they?
Yes.
Right. And they're always about 6 months to a year behind with the latest TalkBack update. How long did it take Samsung to get image descriptions? You know, it took a while. So, and yet you've had image descriptions on Pixels for ages, haven't you? You know, so, you know, I don't personally buy Samsung phones because, you know, if they're going to insult me by not updating TalkBack, you know, in a timely manner, then I don't want to know, you know, but that's just me. You know,
but then you do have a Sony Xperia phone, and does the same not apply?
Does, but you see, I don't use the Sony. Well, you know, I use the Sony Xperia phone more for media.
Yes.
So
okay, so it's like a media player for you.
Yeah, the Sony phone sounds much better than the Pixel. It's got better speakers. It's got Dolby Atmos. Which the Pixel doesn't have. So it's got all these sound related things that I really love, but I'm still ending up going back to a Pixel 10. At the moment I'm using the Sony as a phone because I wanted to see how good it is. But there are things like Wi-Fi calling, for example, that is not as good on the Sony as it is on the Pixel. But Sony are really ace at sound.
Yes.
So
they
I tend
are.
To yeah. You know, I tend to use both, you know, for different things. And the Sony, if you pair Sony phone with Sony earbuds, the sound is phenomenal, you know.
Yeah.
It really is good. And no Pixel can come close. But, you know, I also want all the latest, you know, Google features and TalkBack. Because also for me, I'm a trusted TalkBack tester as well. So I test TalkBack for Google and report bugs. So I need to have the latest TalkBack as well. So really, I need the latest Pixel for that reason, if you know what I mean. But
yeah,
again, if you've got a Pixel 9, even a Pixel 8, even a 7, in fact, you know, you're going to be okay if you're just using it for average phone things, you know. So long as it gets TalkBack 16, which I believe 7 gets, the 6 gets even. I think 6 is the last one that will get TalkBack 16, but that's still 4 years old. So yes, that's pretty good going.
It is.
You know, so if you've got that, they're not, you know, don't rush out to get a new Pixel just because Steve said it's got some wonderful things like camera coach and all that. But on the other hand, if you want to try these things and feed back to Google, I'm sure they'd be happy about that, you know.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. Steve, thank you very much. We'll have you back again at some point to continue this discussion, because it's always good to have a comparison. We talk a lot about iPhones and iOS, so it's really good to have the lifestyle choice that people can make now by having Android instead if they wish, whatever phone they go for. So thanks very much.
You're welcome. And my message is, don't forget, they're both as good in terms of accessibility. There really is parity now, isn't there, Jackie? Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, there is.
They're both as good in terms of accessibility. There's, you know, iPhone does some things Google doesn't do, and Google does some things iPhone doesn't do. But isn't that true with any aspect of a phone, you know? So it is really a lifestyle choice.
It is. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Now on RNIB Tech Talk, we return to the topic of AI chatbots. Now, we've talked about what they are and how to use them effectively, but what I want to talk about is how to use them safely. Joining me back is Trevor A. Strobe. I guess the basic question to start with is, how do you use AI chatbots safely? Bearing in mind, you know, you're giving potentially information to an AI chatbot. You don't know them in person. You've never met them. How do you use them safely?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I think you have to treat it as if it is a stranger. How much of your personal information would you give to a stranger? And even more importantly, any information that you're supplying to this chatbot potentially could be used to train further chatbots. So you have to ask yourself, do you want this information that I'm providing to be inside this chatbot, right? It won't be in there that particular day, but maybe in the future version, that information that you gave it could be included. So you want to be careful about providing any kind of personal information. I would always be generic, you know, I wouldn't provide any specific information about yourself, your location, your where you work, anything. I would not provide that. I would just be general about it. Or any information that you don't want to be public. If there's something that you don't want the public to know, I wouldn't really tell it. I mean, you could ask questions about your health, but in general terms, like to say, you know, can you tell me about this health condition, or what does it mean if I've got this test result back? You don't have to say that it's for you. You can just ask general questions. I think that's fairly safe. But you don't want to relate anything to yourself, right? You know, it would be like posting information in a message board that anybody can read. You want to be careful about what information you're providing. Then you want to do the same thing with AI. Just think about what information do I want to make public and what information do I not.
How much do the chatbots remember of what you say in a particular chat, and they will then use it in future chats? How much of the information you give it do they actually store?
Well, it's becoming more and more, right? So back to like an earlier conversation we had about the context, it's only going to remember as much information as it can hold in the context. So the contexts are getting bigger and bigger. But when you start a new session, that context is gone. So technically, that information is now gone. Now it's stored somewhere. And it, like I said, it could be used for future training. But there's also that information is now being augmented. So in the case of ChatGPT, it has this concept of memories. So what it's doing is it's storing your conversation as a memory, and you can go and view and browse through your past conversations and start them over again. And it's going to use that information to know about more about you, to give you more tailored information. So it's a double-edged sword, right? It's storing more information about you, but it's also using that information to give you more tailored responses. So they do give you the ability to edit those memories. So if you've asked it something that's very very sensitive that you don't want it to store, you can't go in your memories and delete that information. And so I would advise people to do that if there's something that's very sensitive that you do want to get information about or advice about from the chatbot, but you really don't want anybody that information to be shared, I would go and delete that from your memory.
How easy is it to do with a chatbot to say, well, actually, I don't want you to store these things?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? I think it's like anything, there's a price to pay, and the price that we pay is our privacy, right? And that's how we're getting this information, and managing it is tricky, and I don't think we could ever be fully assured that our information is completely removed. We can just do the best with what tools they give us to use, right? And we have to, there's a trust there, and that trust is sometimes breached, and you know, we have to hold these companies accountable when they do. But that's the price that we're going to have to pay for this technology, this information, is that it does know a lot about us.
When it comes to another concern with chatbot safety, and I have caught an AI chatbot give me inaccurate information, I got it stuck in a loop as well when I questioned its information. My question is, are there any ways to spot inaccurate or misleading information that a chatbot might give you?
I guess verify, right? Don't always trust everything it gives you. Try to verify it, I would say. That might be where, you know, tools like Google come in handy to say, you know, especially if it gives you something that just tells you, like, that doesn't sound right. You might want to verify that, especially if it's something you're doing that's technical. You know, you're doing schoolwork, homework, and it gives you some information. You should try to verify that. So maybe what's the old saying, sort of trust but verify, you know? I think that applies.
If I will need to use Google to verify what the chatbot tells me, why should I use a chatbot and not go straight to Google?
I think what it does is it sort of takes that information, summarizes it, gives you, you know, it does still to add some value to it, right? I don't have a good answer for that. Like that's the question. So I think you still have to inform yourself about things, and you still have to, you know, do some work at this point. So I don't think there's any real way around that when it comes to something that's very factual that you need to be very precise about. I think doing some validation, verification is probably something prudent to do.
Is there a way you can ask the chatbot to give you kind of a links or reference points as to where it gets its information from?
So yeah, I see that happening a lot now, especially for the chatbots that have these search capabilities, where they go and say, search the internet, and then they will provide you some references. So that's like you say, and validate those references, because I've heard cases where they hallucinate and they make up fake references. So you can't always, you have to like actually verify those references, right? That they're accurate. So, but there are other tools, like maybe if you're doing more factual searching, you know, probably a tool like maybe Perplexity is a better tool for you. It's AI driven, but it's like an AI search engine, and it does provide you all these references, and you can go there to easily verify it. So that there may be better AIs for different tasks. So maybe doing research where you want factual information, maybe a tool like Perplexity is a better tool than going straight to ChatGPT, because it's designed to reduce hallucinations and provide verifiable results.
Now, when people use these AI chatbots, are there any warnings or red flags they should look out for?
Like, I hear a lot of people getting, you know, sort of therapeutical advice, saying that they've got a lot more out of this than they have from therapists. And I think that they can be a good resource for a lot of people, but you got to be very careful, because sometimes the AI can be very sycophantic, and it could just reinforce things the way that you're feeling. And if you're in a really dark place, it might, you know, I've heard cases where it can take you places you shouldn't be going, right? So you want to be very careful about that. I think they are getting better. Like, as I had said in a previous conversation, they tend not to say no, or they tend to reinforce what you're saying. So you want to be very careful about that. But they are very good for handling certain, you know, very emotionally charged situations. So if you're in, you know, some sort of family dispute or some sort of, you know, relationship where you're having a dispute, sometimes instead of, you know, we people tend to get emotional and tend to say things they regret later. And I've heard of a lot of people where they just say, you know, hey, I had this, you know, problem in this relationship, and then it gives you, a lot of times it will give you a really good say, well, you know, it'll give you a lot of advice, which basically says, you know, calm down and think about it and help you through it. So it could be very good in those situations. But yeah, you want to be very careful because sometimes it can reinforce negative emotions. So you want to be careful about that.
Can these chatbots be used offline in any way for anything at all?
Yeah, absolutely. As I was saying in a previous conversation, you can run these on your computer. They're pretty small models, so they're not as powerful as the ones that we have access to through, you know, ChatGPT and Claude and Gemini. But for some specific tasks, they can be very good, and they're fun. Like if you just want to install something on your computer, I would say like Macintosh computers are the best for running it locally. Just the way the architecture is designed, the way the memory is designed, that they're very, very good at running models locally. They're going to be very slow compared to what you're used to, so it does require some patience. It'll be like, if anybody's had any experience connecting to a computer that's very far away and you start to type and it's sort of like you're typing faster than the characters appear on the screen. It'll be like that. It'll be typing its response very, very slowly, just a few characters at a time. But if you're patient and you can wait, you'll get, you know, some answers back. And it's, like I say, it's a fun thing to do. If you're on a PC, you're going to need a GPU card. They are fairly expensive, especially the more memory that it has. But they can be had for, you know, a few $100s to a few $1,000s or more. So it can be a very expensive hobby. And it tends to become addictive. Like if you have a small machine and you run a very small model and you say, wow, this is really fun. And then you see its limitations. You instinctively want to run a bigger, more capable model. And of course that's requires better hardware and, you know, it can start becoming a very expensive hobby.
Well, that is quite interesting because I didn't realize how much you can actually use these offline, which adds to it. That ends part three. In our part four of the AI chatbot series, we will actually take a look at what is there for the future of these chatbots, which, bearing in mind how quickly technology moves on, can be quite exciting. But for now, Trevor A. Strope, thank you very much for joining us once again on RNIB Tech Talk.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
AbbeyWare is a trailblazer for blind and partially sighted STEM students. Amelia Hilton has been hearing about how Abby overcame challenges in her own studies and how she plans to support future students.
Abby Way recently graduated from Product Design Engineering at Queen's University, and she was the first student with a significant visual impairment to complete the course. She even launched her own charity, Boomerang, to help visually impaired children and young people access STEM education. She received the National Trust Time and Space Award during her placement year and recently won the Enactus Spark 2025 competition to support Boomerang's growth. She was also awarded the Walter Wilson Scholarship from Ulster Carpets for her contribution to the School of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at Queen's. Hi, Abby. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So can we start with you telling us about your level of vision?
Yes. So I was born with a condition called oculocutaneous albinism and nystagmus. So it means I'm extremely sensitive to light. I usually read at about font size 32, but I do find reading screens and things harder because of the lighting behind them. On average, my vision is about 6/24. So what someone could see 24 meters away, I'd need to be about 6 meters away to see the same as them.
And what first made you decide to pursue product design engineering? Where did your passion begin?
So it's a bit of a weird one, actually. I have been obsessed with space since I was about 6 years old. Someone gave me a large print book on space, and I was going to do astrophysics, but I really enjoy doing things that are hands-on and a bit more creative and problem-solving as well. So I thought, instead of doing astrophysics, which would be much more sort of research-based and passive learning, I wanted to do something more engaging. So I went down the route of engineering and looked at mechanical engineering and some of the others, but product design engineering had more of the creativity in it that I really like. So I've done product design engineering, but I've kind of applied it all to the space industry and mixed a lot of that in. I think, yeah, I've always been quite an arty person. I enjoy things like writing my own music, and I've recently got into performing my music as well. When I was younger, discovered I really enjoyed cake decorating with fondant. So I'd make little figures and make quite snazzy cakes with that on top, which was quite niche, but really good fun. So yeah, I've always kind of been quite artsy and creative in that sense. But what I really liked about my course was merging all of the science, which I've also always loved, with that creative side and kind of mixing the two together, which has been really fun.
And the course and the field traditionally has a lot of vision-led software and tools. So how did you navigate using those or finding alternatives on your course?
Yes, it is definitely quite a visual course. And I didn't quite know what to expect when I started, because we don't study engineering in school. So I'd never done engineering before. I kind of knew what it was, but I also kind of didn't at the same time. One of the biggest challenges was using all the software, because it's a requirement for the course to use a certain variety of software. But unfortunately, at the moment, that software is not designed with many, if any, accessibility features. So the biggest challenge was the fact that I couldn't see some of the things that were a definite need for the course. But after a lot of time talking to the uni, one thing that was really nice and quite a big change from school was that it was a conversation with the uni about what the problem was and how we were going to work together to overcome the problem. So it was much less of a fight and much more of a discussion, which was really good. I had one-to-one support where someone acted as my eyes, and that was really helpful. Basically, they sat in class with me and learned the class content. It was a bit of a long-winded process. They learned the class content, kind of taught it to me, and I learned it from watching them and memorized where all the buttons were. But I also had other things that helped me, like my iPad. I could not have done my degree or school for that matter without my iPad. I take all of my notes on my iPad using an app called GoodNotes, because it allows you to change the thickness of the pen. Having it digitally makes it a lot clearer than writing in a biro. You can change the background colours, you can highlight things, you can draw shapes and make it look all pretty. You can change the colour of the paper that you're writing on as well. So I find that really helpful. And I also have an app on my iPad called Calculator Plus. I found calculators are very difficult to see, and the ones that I can see don't usually have all the different buttons that I need for the level of maths that I've been doing on my course. So that's been really helpful as well.
Yeah, it sounds like you really navigated the challenges well, and that you felt like your course designers really worked with you. Were there any frustrating moments or moments where big barriers came up?
There were definitely a few barriers. I mean, being the first person with a visual impairment to do this course at my university meant that when I arrived, there was a bit of uncertainty of whose responsibility it was to support me within the university, whether that came from learning support or whether that came from the School of Engineering themselves. So it took a while to work out how that funding was going to work to support me. And there was also, you know, you always get the odd lecturer who doesn't quite understand and you end up having a back and forth with them. I had a lecturer who I asked them to change the colour background on a PowerPoint because I couldn't see it. And they changed it on their own personal laptop, but not the presentation that they shared with the whole class. And they didn't understand why, if they had a different colour background on their laptop, that wasn't helping me on my laptop. So that was interesting. But yeah, there's been quite a few bumps, obviously. But as I say, it's also been really helpful that the university have listened to that. And where there have been cases where lecturers have maybe not quite understood or not quite been able to help when I hope they would, learning support have been really good at stepping in and kind of taking the weight off my shoulders and talking to the lecturers for me, which has been really helpful because, again, that was different in school. It was me who was talking to all the teachers all the time. So it was really helpful to kind of have someone in my corner who backed me and helped me whenever I needed it, regardless of where the issue was.
You recently received funding to support Boomerang's growth from Enactus. Can you tell us why you wanted to start the charity and what kind of activities you want to offer?
Boomerang is the charity that I'm setting up to support and inspire other young visually impaired people into STEM subjects. It's felt like an upward battle the entire way through my education. And there have been cases in my own life and other people that I know as well, where there have been significant barriers that have never got resolved. And that's ended up in people not getting the grades that they want. And that's obviously had a kind of knock-on effect for applying to uni and getting jobs and all of those things. So I have set up Boomerang to hopefully make things easier for the younger people coming through the education system now. And I ran a pilot event whilst I did my year in industry with Airbus Defence and Space. And we took four children who are significantly visually impaired round, and I was able to show them the Mars rover that Airbus is building. And we had 3D printed models of some of the different satellite models. And we also had a tactile moon that we printed off. We had scents of all the different planets, because depending on the gases they have, they all smell different. So we made it a really interactive, really like good sensory day for learning about space, which was an experience that, well, I don't think anyone would get in the classroom, to be honest, but especially for a group of children who can't see, it was so amazing to see them get so excited about it and learn things that would be very hard to learn in a different setting.
Absolutely. And it's such a great opportunity you're creating for other people coming up through the education system. What are some of your longer term plans for Boomerang?
One of the things that I'm really pleased to say and will take forward is that Enactus have given me the first round of grant funding for Boomerang. So it's all becoming official, which is very exciting. So with that grant funding and with the support of the National Trust, kind of got the next steps lined up for Boomerang, which would be more events and activities of taking children outside of the classroom and into an environment that's fully designed for them. Everything is accessible. And I also am keen to work with whatever the children want. If we have children who are passionate about medicine, I want to be able to take them in and maybe get them to feel and check out some of the operation tools and things like that. I want to make it as interactive as possible and tailored to the children. But I'm also really keen to create a community network where older people like myself, maybe parents and teachers as well, can communicate with the younger people in the education system, and we can share tips and tricks on how to access those science subjects. If you have a teacher who maybe has a child and they're doing a science experiment and they don't know how to adapt it for that child with a visual impairment, instead of the teacher just writing it off and saying it's not possible for that child to take part in that experiment, I'd hope to build a place where that teacher could come online and ask the rest of the community how to adapt it, and we can all feed in together and make sure that no child has to sit there and miss out on anything in science subjects. So hopefully that'll help build a bit of confidence for the teachers and also give a bit of support for the children to come in and connect with all of us as well, and kind of keep that momentum going and keep inspiring children to get into STEM and make things a bit easier.
And for people who are visually impaired in schools at the moment and considering their next steps, who are maybe being told that they can't pursue what they want to because of expected challenges, what would you say?
Go for it. Don't let anyone tell you it's too difficult. I think one of the great things about being visually impaired and blind, or just having any disability, is that you know how to problem solve and you know how to overcome barriers. You're determined. Don't let anyone tell you that you're not. Go for it and work it out as you go. There's always going to be things that are difficult in life, and obviously it's not going to be easy, but if you want it, don't let anything stop you.
And Abby, where can people learn more about you and Boomerang?
Yes, so I'm currently in the process of beginning to build the website, which is very exciting. I don't have a link for that yet, because obviously it doesn't quite exist yet, but it's becoming to exist. So the best way to contact me, if you want to find out more, is probably by my email address, abi.vi.stem@gmail.com. So that's abi.vi.stem@gmail.com. If you're someone who's young, visually impaired in school, and you have a particular subject area that you think you want to learn more about and would like to do a Boomerang activity with, feel free to drop me an email, because we want to tailor it to whatever you guys need, whatever you want to learn more about. I want this to be a place where you can come and ask, and we can do.
Well, thank you so much, Abby Way, for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
And that's just about all we've got time for this week. Thank you, as always, for joining us and for tuning in. If you've got any comments, any questions, any tips you want to share, doesn't have to be massively technical. Could be sometimes the low-tech solutions are the best. If there's anything that we should be talking about, let us know. We always love to hear from you. techtalk@rnib.org.uk is that all-important email address. We'll be back with you next week. But until then, from me, Callum Stoneman, Jackie Brown, and Natalie Curran, bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
See you next week.